Welcome to the Go Health podcast. I am Gillian Strain, Chief Exec of Go Health, an organization with a vision to enable churches and individual Christians to be a healing presence in the world. And on our podcast, we love to have great conversations to inspire all of us to connect health and faith. Now, my guest today is Reverend Tristan Owain Hughes, who is a Welsh theologian, an author, and a broadcaster. You might have heard him on BBC Pause for Thought. And he's known for making deep Christian spirituality accessible, compassionate, and hopeful, which is what we're all about. Tristan currently serves as the Church in Wales's first Director of Ministry Development, and he has in his background years of experience as a parish priest, a university chaplain, and also as a canon theologian at Llandaff Cathedral. So Tristan's also the author of several widely appreciated books on our topic today, which is faith, suffering, compassion and prayer, including Finding Hope and Meaning in Suffering. And his latest book is called To Hell's Mouth and Back, Pilgrimage, Suffering and Hope. Tristan, hello. It's lovely to see you.
Lovely to be here.
I'm really excited you're on the podcast to chat about you and your approach to things, and also this book, which is about pilgrimage. Why did you go on a pilgrimage in North Wales and then write a book about it?
Well, the pilgrimage I went on was 8 years ago, but the story starts much earlier than that. Starts almost 20 years ago when I had major back surgery. I had a titanium bolt put between the vertebra of my spine. And by 2017, I still had a chronic pain, disability, but I felt strong enough for a challenge. So I live in Cardiff now, but I'm from the North Wales coast, a little place called Penmaen Mawr, which is actually referenced in Dylan Thomas's Under Milk Wood. Mm. It's that famous. So I grew up with stories in Penmaen Mawr about one of the most challenging pilgrimages in the UK, which is called the Pilgrim's Way. It's a 140-mile walk across the top of North Wales to a little island called Bardsey Island, the Island of the Saints, or in Welsh we call it Ynys Enlli. So I felt my back had improved enough for a challenge. So I put my walking shoes on, I threw my rucksack over my back, and I started walking. And why I ended up writing a book about it, well, there's not a simple answer to that question either. But to say it was an eventful walk is an understatement. And the challenge of the walk was nothing compared to the physical and mental challenge of what came after that. And that all sounds rather bleak, but there's another side to the story. The book is not about despair. When we suffer, it's actually about hope.
So the book, I mean, I've read it and I've loved it and I've appreciated it because there's sort of two pilgrimages, sort of the physical one and the one that came after, which is about recovery. So tell us a little bit about the first pilgrimage, the physical one across North Wales, and some of the surprising ways you did just that pilgrimagey thing of connecting to God. How did that happen for you?
Well, initially, I'd taken a sabbatical to do this pilgrimage, and the aim was to do lots of different pilgrimages to really explore that question you've just asked. You know, what actually is a pilgrimage? And through the pilgrimage across the top of North Wales, I came to realise that pilgrimages have different elements. Suffering is one of those elements. Pilgrimages are never easy. On my own Pilgrim's Way walk, very early on, I had quite a serious knee injury. So through the whole 140 miles, I was suffering with patella tendonitis in my knee. But on top of that, there were so many other challenges. I got lost so many times. I had battles with barbed wire and gnashing dogs. There was awful weather. Coming from North Wales, I should have guessed there'd be awful weather, but I hadn't quite even realized that. But suffering is just one of the elements that defines a pilgrimage. So the other elements are those things that help us keep going despite the struggle, despite the challenges. And those are the places where we find God, where we connect with God. And in the book, I look at four other places where I think God can be found in journeys. So there's the wonder of nature and place. There's friendship. There's our dependence on others and our dependence on God. And there's amazing signs from God. And on top of all that, and bringing those together, is that message of hope and where we find hope in our journeys.
And you started there with suffering. It's not just that suffering is something you've got to get over in order to find God. Suffering for pilgrimage is very much part of it, isn't it?
It is. It's integral to the journey. All our pilgrimages, all our journeys will have suffering in some way. When you commit to a walk like that, you know 140 miles isn't going to be easy. You know you're going to be lying in salt baths at the end of every night and putting so much Vaseline on your feet because of the pain of the blisters that come up. So suffering is part and parcel of pilgrimage, just like suffering is part and parcel of all our journeys.
And there's a whole host of writing in this area, isn't it? You referenced so many different authors in your book, but the one I'm thinking about now is Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning. Actually, it's suffering. It's finding the meaning in the suffering, but also finding out who we are through the suffering too. Is that part of pilgrimage, do you think?
Exactly. And that was the challenge of the pilgrimage was what is the meaning of doing this? And it was a weird thing to start off because at first, the meaning for me, I remember my bishop saying to me when I took my sabbatical, why are you going out to walk 140 miles? And all I could say was to get to the end. So that was the meaning at the time. But journeys are transformative. So the meaning becomes something very, very different. And Viktor Frankl was hugely influential. It had been in my first book, Finding Hope and Meaning in Suffering. I based it around where Viktor Frankl found meaning. So that was it. But in this book, he also is influential, as was Edith Eger, who's another Holocaust survivor, another psychologist, who again found meaning in choice and the choices we make, to find those little moments of light in our lives.
And this was all pilgrimages are certain routes, they're not just 140 miles in one direction. Well, how important was place and ancient spaces for you in this healing journey?
Well, the walk itself, of course, obviously, if you're in Wales, you're in the Celtic landscape, and it's littered with places of healing and power. It even starts in Basingwork Abbey, which is just outside Holywell. And some people will have heard of Holywell, where the medieval shrine of St. Winifred is. So that immediately gets you thinking about healing. As you walk into the shrine, which the actual Pilgrim's Way walks past the shrine, so I stopped off at the shrine. And as you walk into the shrine, there's dozens of crutches left by the entrance. So you see that physical healing has happened in this place. And so there's that question, is that what healing is? Is it physical healing? And then along the way, you have powerful remnants of the Celtic past. You have remote churches, healing wells, healing crosses. All these places have been so important to people down the years, and some will have experienced some kind of physical healing there, but most will have experienced, like I experienced, some kind of inner healing, some kind of inspiration, some kind of reassurance from God in these unbelievably special places.
Yeah. What I love about the book is you paint a picture of the journey as well and your connection to nature, and you don't romanticize it. But I was really, we run a charity that connects faith and health, and I learned lots of your book, but one of the things I learned was about goldfinches, the wee birds that have long been associated with Christian healing. I had no idea. So tell us a bit about goldfinches.
Well, I suppose it's one of those big ironies that when we're going through difficult times, when we're facing struggle, when we're facing challenges and suffering, we feel distant from God, but God also turns up. There's a famous album by a singer-songwriter called David Gray called Life in Slow Motion. And people often find when they're suffering, life somehow slows down and we get to open our eyes to where the real blessings in life are. And so I tell the story in the book of when I started to notice those moments when God connected with me, moments when God prompted me, directed me, comforted me. God winks is what one theologian calls those, but I call them my goldfinch moments. And it's because of a story I tell when I was facing a particular time of darkness after the walk. And I was lying on my sofa, deep pain and, real depression. And I looked outside, and there, looking directly at me, was a goldfinch. And it lifted me. And for some reason, I was prompted to pick up my iPad. I have no idea why I did this. I picked up my iPad and I typed in, what is the meaning of seeing a goldfinch? And suddenly, there were hundreds of pictures of Jesus holding goldfinches. And as you say, it turns out they're birds of healing. And it's believed that the red on their beak is because they were taking thorns out of Jesus's crown of thorns. And so there I was in pain and distress, and I'm visited by this traditional bird of healing. Was that a coincidence? Maybe, but God definitely used that moment to give me hope and lifted my heart.
And I think there's two things there. I was reading your book, actually. I was on Holy Island just a couple of months ago, and I was having a tough time. And I read your stuff about goldfinches. I was like, right, that's it. I'm going for a walk, and I'm going to look for a goldfinch. And I didn't see one, Tristan. But it inspired me to slow down and look at nature. And that's actually not all of us can go for a walk in North Wales, or some people can't even leave the house, but we can all look with different eyes. And that really struck me as sort of a healing thing we can all participate in. Whatever situation we're in.
Yeah, where is your goldfinch? You know, where are your goldfinch moments? I suppose that's the thing. And I've had so many people sending me little messages about goldfinches and pictures of goldfinches, but it lifts my heart that people are also thinking, okay, you know, that happened with you to a goldfinch, but with me it can happen with a tree, or with a cat that walks past, or just something that lifts your heart in some ways and connects you with something larger than our everyday mundane existence.
And it's having the confidence to not only see them, but name them as well. These God winks, these God incidences as well. It's a gut thing, isn't it? When something weird happens, you're like, oh, hang on, maybe there's more to what I'm just seeing.
Exactly.
But Tristan, how would you help people to have confidence in whatever their goldfinch moment is, to really embed that as a sign, an old-fashioned sign that I'm with you?
It's taking time and space, isn't it? And that, I suppose, that's part of what prayer is. It's taking time and space to recognize and think, maybe there was some meaning in what I saw then. I mean, like that goldfinch story, there were so many weird, strange stories that happened both on my walk and after the walk. And I look at those in my book, Strange Coincidences, almost blow your mind. I mean, I remember on the walk itself, I walked into a remote church in North Wales on my pilgrimage, and then I was confronted with the faces of my wife and daughter. They weren't there, but they were on the front cover of an old magazine from years earlier, decade earlier, and it was prominently displayed in the church, and it was the only magazine that was there, and there they were.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that famous quote by Archbishop William Temple, "When I pray, coincidences happen." When we're on pilgrimages, somehow coincidences do happen. And it doesn't have to be a wacky thing to believe this. I mean, I was hugely affirmed when I did research for this and found that my academic mind could be taken into this idea of coincidences. And because there is a scientific background into these strange moments of fate and synchronicity. So you've got Carl Jung, who writes about synchronicity. He said, people don't see God in their lives because they don't look low enough. And then 100 years after Carl Jung, you've still got scientists talking about the importance of coincidences and signs. There was a book recently called The Signs, written by Tara Swart, a world-renowned neuroscientist, and she brings together breathtaking real life stories with research from cognitive science to show that we should be taking these moments seriously. We should be taking time and space to interpret them.
Yeah, absolutely. We've just had a course in Go Health called Spiritual Intelligence, which is a bit like emotional intelligence, but for spiritual people, backed up with the work of psychologists and neuroscience. Our consciousness extends outside our bodies and is intertwined with nature. That's what quantum mechanics tells us. So, and I think the science does help, makes us feel a bit more confident in these God incidences, these God winks in our life.
And that's an exciting thing, isn't it? It's an exciting thing to recognize that actually we can open our eyes to these moments of wonder and actually root them in our modern way of thinking.
Yeah, these are, you know, mystical moments in action. You know, when you're making a cup of tea, you're just going for a normal walk, or you know, in hospital looking out a window.
Yeah,
you know, God is still with us in all of this. Tristan, I want to move on to the other journey that you write about in this book, the one through your own suffering. After the pilgrimage, your back injury flares again. Can you tell us a bit about, give us some of the background so we get a sense of that moment for us? And you've already mentioned your sofa, which becomes sort of the central point, still point for the second pilgrimage.
Exactly. I mean, I've lived with chronic pain now for 20 years, and the doctors don't really know why this happened. But in my early 30s, I had a back injury, and the pain just got worse and worse. And what is clear is that it started to impact my life more and more. I had MRI scan after MRI scan, and they showed degeneration, prolapsed discs, had an operation, then had to spend a whole month in hospital learning how to hoover the house properly and wash dishes properly without affecting my back. And so I felt like I was strong enough to take this walk on in the Pilgrim's Way. And I did manage to get right to the end and crossed on a glorious sunny day to Bardsey Island. But literally the next day, I woke up in extreme back pain again. And I was thrown for the months after that into the depths of pain and despair again. And that's why this book isn't, as you say, about one pilgrimage. It's here's a story of two pilgrimages. It's the story of the literal pilgrimage across the top of North Wales, but also a more metaphorical pilgrimage as I recover from that back injury and face further chronic pain and mental anguish.
You were sort of stuck there, weren't you?
Yeah.
So the opposite of a pilgrimage. You couldn't walk, you couldn't move. You were stuck in your house. You're in the middle of your working life. You've got young kids. What was that like for you just to have to stop there? What was going through your head?
Well, I think at the heart of pilgrimage is a tension between suffering and hope. And so I was dragged down to in a moment, to a really, really low place. And all of us have times in our lives when we face those kind of places, whether it's through illness, grief, unemployment, depression. And our wilderness moments challenge us. They force us to face the big questions in life. And I suppose that was the real challenge, was just to keep going. When I was a young person, I was obsessed with martial arts. Never did any martial arts, but I used to watch it on TV, films, Bruce Lee especially, Jackie Chan, but Bruce Lee was my favourite actor. And I remember seeing an interview with Bruce Lee, and he said whenever he's frightened, whenever he was scared, he'd just repeat to himself, "Walk on, Bruce, walk on." And I think that was the reality. You know, there are times in all our lives when all we can do is keep walking on. That's what I was facing at that point. I just had to keep going.
Did you know you'd get better, or were you uncertain about that too?
I was certain I wouldn't get better, because the mind takes you to very, very strange places. And I was taken to a place which at the time felt unbearable. The searing pain in my back and my legs were nothing compared to the tricks my mind started playing. I felt so bleak, a roller coaster of dark emotions coping with the pain. And I recognized that compared to others, what I went through was a drop in the ocean. Over the years, as someone who's ministered to people, who's been involved in pastoral care, I've stood beside people in the depths of unimaginable suffering, heartbreak, guilt, grief, guilt, devastating diagnoses. But the reality is, when I look at this myself, I recognize that we have to take all suffering seriously. So what I went through, I have to be kind to myself and recognize, for me, it seemed like that it was the end, because for me, that suffering became all-consuming. You've mentioned Viktor Frankl already, who survived the Nazi death camps. And he warns against, even though he went through what he went through in Auschwitz, he warns against measuring suffering or comparing suffering. He describes suffering like gas released into an empty chamber. If there's a little bit of gas, it fills the chamber. If there's a lot of gas, it fills the chamber. It expands. In other words, the size of suffering is relative. Doesn't matter how big your suffering is, how small your suffering is, it has the power to consume us completely. And it certainly did. I just couldn't see any color in my life, any vibrancy, any joy. I lost all perspective. Life seemed bleak.
And was it just a case of hanging on, or did anything actually help in that moment?
Well, the centrality of hope is what really helped. You know, my faith is based around hope, but all our, you know, if we're Christians, our faith is a faith of resurrection and hope. Hope is so needed in our world today, and that is something that I just had to hold on to.
And were you able to, Tristan, in that moment? We can all look backwards and say, in retrospect, you know, and all, but in that moment,
Well, I think I had to reinvent where I was finding hope. I think that was the thing. Because I was stuck on this red sofa and only going for short walks, I had to think, well, I mean, in the middle of the night was almost, it was pointless even trying to. That they were the lowest moments. But then the day would start and the light would come through the window and, you know, my family would be around, friends would come around, you know, I'd be given a pack of chocolates and I'd enjoy a little chocolate and little bits of hope were coming through, conversations with people, texts I had. R.S. Thomas, the Welsh poet, who actually was vicar of the village where the Pilgrim's Way actually ends at the top of the, at the end of the Llyn Peninsula, where you travel out to Bardsey Island. Now, R.S. Thomas talks about confetti moments, that we need to open our eyes to the confetti moments in our lives, where hope is coming through, where love is present, where joy is breaking through. And I think, you know, I think our Welsh, my Welsh heritage has helped me with that. We actually have two words, for example, for peace in Welsh.
Oh, really?
We have heddwch, which is peace on the outside, and we have tangnefedd, which is peace on the inside. Mm. And I think it's finding those moments of tangnefedd, the inner peace, that's where hope comes.
And I was so struck in the book, first about you've chosen to use your personal story to teach. But it was the things that kept you going on your wild pilgrimage in North Wales. They were the same things that kept you going on your red sofa.
Exactly. And I started talking about a pilgrimage mindset, which is why I can really recognize this second journey of recovery from injury as a pilgrimage. And because we could have a pilgrimage mindset in whatever we're going through. So it was those moments of light that came through from nature. I lived at the time next to a lake, a city lake, and just those when I was able to just get myself down to the side of that lake, literally a 30-yard walk, and just sit there and just be there, resting in nature was so important. It was the support of family and friends and even strangers. You know, it was those kind of little moments. It was the little moments of coincidences. It was the light was coming through.
You've written about suffering extensively before. Why have you chosen to tell your story? That's a really vulnerable thing to do.
I know. It's.
I think it's great. It's not criticism. I think it's wonderful.
No, it's wonderful. But yeah, I mean, it's something. It's not natural to me. To talk about myself, I've written. This is my 8th book, and all the others have not had a lot of me, and they've had lots of stories about my family and instances that happened, but not necessarily the real me. And my first very popular book, Finding Hope and Meaning in Suffering, was 15 years ago. And people would read it and say, you know, we know you've written this because of what you're going through with your back. Why isn't there more of you in there? They were surprised how little of me there was in there. So this time I wanted to do something different. I wanted to open my life to others. I wanted to give them a glimpse of my personal experience.
And how has that felt to be that vulnerable? Has that been, I said this is hard, but how have you done that? How have you lived into being that vulnerable? Because it's pretty public.
It's been difficult because I don't want to be defined by the suffering I'm going through or have been through. Yeah. I don't want to be defined by my disability. I remember when my back was bad, I went to get a walking stick to help me walk. And someone said to me, don't use that. And I was surprised when they said that. And I asked, well, why? And they said, well, people won't see you when you use that. They'll see the stick. And that really jarred with me. It was so hard for me to comprehend how people can put all our identity into one part of us. So yes, it is difficult to put ourselves, to be vulnerable and put ourselves open like this. But actually, it's also hugely helped. What I've been through, what I go through daily, it's almost taken a weight off my shoulders to be able to share it. It's been liberating and freeing to just being open and saying, this is who I am. I know people have lived with that burden for years in different ways of, you know, people not quite knowing who I am. And it's lovely to put it out there and say, I want you to love me and accept me for what I am.
And what do you think that weight's about? You say it takes a weight off. What's that bit?
It's the hiddenness, I think. So it's the hiddenness.
It's the pain of hiding who
you are. Yeah, of hiding who you are and feeling people will judge you for who you are and people will see you and define you for that little bit of your life.
And in the book, which bits have been most difficult to share? Which particular bits of the vulnerability? Is it the pain thing that you're limited in some way?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It's the disability rather than, it's quite easy to say, I went through this for a few months. So my mind went to a very dark place at that time.
Yeah.
Because people just say, well, yeah, I've had times that have been low as well. But to lay your life open and say, I still struggle. You know, I still live with chronic pain. I still have moments when, you know, I getting out of bed is difficult, not just mentally, but physically to get yourself out of bed and start moving. That's quite a difficult thing to say because people will judge and think, well, you can't do this and you can't do that. Whereas actually what I want to be is affirmed and felt, well, I can do things, but I just have to put things into place.
Is it that you still need, that you need help?
It probably is. I mean, we were in a meeting a few weeks back and I had to say at the beginning to everybody, I had to tell people at the beginning in this meeting, it was a day meeting, I will be getting up and walking around the side of the meeting because that is the only way I can cope with my pain. And that put me in a very vulnerable place in that meeting.
And how did people respond, Tristan, when that happened? Did you meet compassion or did you meet judgment?
I'd like to think I met compassion, but of course you don't know what's in people's heads when you say these things and when you open yourself in those ways. So I would like to think I was met with compassion, and people generally are compassionate, but people also want to make things right for you. And that's a good thing, but it can also, when I first had my operation, people said to me, oh, you should go to my osteopath or you should go to my physiotherapist and you'll be absolutely fine then because they've done wonders on my back. And so people want good for you, but actually what you want is just people to accept you, people to accept and think, okay, that's what's needed. You know, I'm here if you need me, but I'm not going to try and sort it for you.
It's walking the edge, isn't it? I think this is something I think about and struggle with a lot, how open I am about what's going on for me and my health in the past. Because, you know, I'm both leaders and have positions of responsibility. So being vulnerable, saying you have needs is a tough thing when you're in charge of stuff. Like you've got a significant senior job, a new role in Church of Wales. You're helping shaping vocations and shaping the church in Wales. And doing that with a lived vulnerability is tough. Are there ways that you've seen that it makes you a better leader because you're vulnerable?
Well, as you say, in my work as a director of ministry development, one of the big parts of my work is running the discernment process in the church in Wales. In other words, how we decide who are going to be the next generation of priests and deacons and lay ministers. And one of the first thing I did when I took on this post 3 years ago was put together new criteria. What qualities are we looking for in a leader? And there was very little in the old criteria in the church in Wales about vulnerability and about weakness. And now that's all changed. So the new criteria, the new qualities, I think it's so important to recognize that our weaknesses, our vulnerabilities are part of who we are and can be just so powerful to us as leaders. I've been watching recently with the family the BBC series Superman and Lois, and I've noticed something really striking about it. The strong characters in Superman and Lois, the TV series, are not the superheroes, but are the ordinary folk, are the family back home. Lois Lane herself facing a cancer diagnosis. Clark Kent supporting his kids with courage and hope. Jonathan Kent, the son who hadn't inherited the abilities. We don't want supermen in our churches. We want Lois Lanes. We want Clark Kents. We want Jonathan Kents. We've already got a saviour. What we want are real people, people who are vulnerable, who are open, who are compassionate, humans who dare to be honest and kind.
Have you seen in your work, Tristan, I know the book's out just recently, But as a leader showing vulnerability and telling a story, have you had experiences of other leaders then coming to you and telling their story? Because it seems to be this opportunity here to break open a bit some of the shininess we think we need to have if we're leading, and just to be a bit honest about what it's really like.
I've certainly had conversations within the discernment process with people who are exploring ministry, encouraging them to open their whole life to their ministry and to be open with where they are. And I think this book has helped them and will help them in that. But I also remember years ago, so before this book was written, going to a service and a priest preaching about the miscarriages his family had faced down the years. And it was so powerful, so vulnerable. The reality is we remember very, very few sermons that we go to. But I remembered that one. I remembered that one because it was a great model of leadership.
Yes.
A Christian model of leadership. When we are weak, we are strong, St. Paul said. Jesus himself, inspired through his compassion and vulnerability, through the pain that he went through for others. There's a tension. There's a tension there. If every sermon was about our vulnerabilities,
yes,
we'd be missing the point completely. But helping people see that our leaders, our priests, are like others, that have weaknesses, that's an important step.
And of course, priests and leaders, they're not rocks or islands. They are surrounded by communities of support and their families and the organization that they work in. Tristan, what's been your support over your recovery and your ongoing recovery?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a whole chapter in the book about companionship and friendship and family. So that has been absolutely central to what has really brought me hope and what has brought me joy during the difficult times. And then there's also the nature side as well. So that's not a person, but places have brought me hope and joy. It's just those little moments that have lifted my heart, those moments where God's light shines in some way through the difficulty of the day or the monotony of the day, moments of colour that pierce through the greyness of what we feel. And they can come from all sorts of places. For me, those are the two places, really, through other people and through nature. And I've been reflecting on that recently. It's easy to fall into that trap and thinking we need to be in the wild countryside to get that, or we need to be in a buzzing party to get that from other people. But we can open our eyes and ears and hearts, and we can be blessed wherever we are. And I mean, that's become so important to me just in my, you know, when I was walking down the road these last few days, just walking backwards and forwards to meetings and so on. And just the road I live on has given me those moments. You know, I live next to school, so hearing the laughter of children every break time has just lifted my heart. It's just given me hope. It's just a little thing. But when I hear that school bell go and hear the children run out and the screams of fun and laughter just lifts my heart. In the same way as, you know, very urban streets, but walking past the trees, there's something about the existence of trees that I used to take for granted. And now, you know, perhaps it's that pilgrimage mindset now that I feel some kind of connection to even the very dull trees that are on my streets. Well, they're not dull anymore. They're not simple, ordinary trees. They're bursting through the concrete. There's little shoots of green around the base. There's something uplifting, inspiring, healing about them.
I was thinking of you the other day in my garden. We've an old apple tree and it blew over. It's been around, must be around for hundreds of years. And I thought of you. I was gutted. I love this tree. But I was inspired from what you said to take it here. So I had a little chat with the tree. I thanked it.
Oh, lovely.
I said, sorry, I'm not very good at gardening. Maybe I should have chopped the branches earlier. So I felt gutted. It's fallen over. But I felt I connected with it as it was coming to the end of its life. These moments can happen, you know, anywhere, can't they?
Exactly.
If you've got eyes to see them. Yeah, exactly. Tristan, it's been wonderful to have you on the podcast. Thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you.
what's the rest of your day hold? Will you be able to take a rest after this, or do you feel energized? Or are you?
I do feel like one of the things that I need to do daily is pop to the gym just to keep my back going. So I cleared this morning because I knew I was speaking to you. We've had a nice chat, so I'm gonna go to the gym now just for 20 minutes on the cross trainer just to keep this back moving.
Yeah, it's so important to look after our physical bodies, isn't it?
It is.
And do all of these things. So thank you, Director of Ministry, for modeling something really profound in your book, but also living out a holistic well-being, looking after your body, your mind, and your spirit. If you'd like to find out more about Tristan's latest book, it's all in the show notes. And we'll be picking up this conversation over in our Go Health community. Members of the Go Health community receive all of our online courses, all monthly gatherings. And in the community, we curate a place to belong, where together we'll explore how to connect faith and health, whatever life throws at us. And if you're a leader and you're interested in picking up this conversation around vulnerability and leading in impactful ways for the times we're living in, right, we need good leaders, do also check out the show notes and see how we work with you and with organizations. A huge thank you, of course, to Rosie Dawson for producing this podcast, and to Wendy Lloyd for all her work on the podcast and the Go Health community. So thank you for listening, and may you know God's healing presence in your life and in the world. Thank you again, Tristan. It's lovely to spend time with you.
Thank you.